ending. You stole my heart, but I love you anyway.
It's a true story, give or take a lie or two. It's a very true story. I had no idea it was going to be that big. I mean, no idea whatsoever. If you'd have told me in 1970 that you're going to have a number one single in America and all around the world, really, I would have said, oh, forget it. Especially as Maggie May nearly didn't make the album. This is Rod Stewart, and Every Picture Tells a Story when you're in the studio.
My first day as a freshman at college in September 1971, the image is indelibly stamped in my memory forever, because the sound of Rod Stewart's Every Picture Tells a Story seemed to be blasting out of every open window in the freshman dorm. The symbolism is just too perfect. There I was, emancipated for the first time in my life, about to experience life, learning, love on my own for the very first time. And what is the soundtrack I hear? AllMusic.com writer Stephen Thomas Erlewine notes, and I quote, "The great triumph of Rod Stewart's Every Picture Tells a Story lies in its content. Every song on the album, whether it's a cover or original, is a gem, combining to form a romantic, earthy portrayal of a young man joyously celebrating his young life. Few rock albums are quite this powerful or this rich," end quote. In May 1971, you would have needed a scorecard to keep up with Rod Stewart's recordings. Every Picture Tells a Story was Rod Stewart's third solo album, coming within weeks of his second as lead singer of The Faces. Rod, it seemed, was everywhere then, but the path to that success was a long one and by no means straight. Rod Stewart grew up in working-class North London on Archway Road, and although Rod thinks of himself at times as a Scot, Stewart was not born in Scotland.
Well, I've got a Scottish father, that's
Scottish
all.
Scottish father.
So I've got, you know, 1 pint of Scottish blood versus 7 pints of English blood. Very soccer-mad family I come from, absolutely soccer-mad, and in love with Scottish football. That's why I support the Scottish national team.
Mm.
But I had a very, very marvellous childhood. No complaints about my childhood whatsoever. It was very happy. Big family. I come from a family of five. Dad was what we call a master builder. He had about 10 or 15 guys working for him, and then he retired when he was 65, and he bought a sweet shop, a tobacconist shop, and so we all lived above that. And I remember well, because I was still doing a paper round. When I was trying to be a musician, my dad was real good. He'd always give me a few pounds to keep me going over the weekend, but he'd also make me do a paper round, which is very humiliating when you're about 18 or 19, you know, because little kids do paper rounds. That's he'd true. Make me do a paper round.
That's right.
So they were very, very supportive, my mother and father, of me being in music. I think basically because I had two brothers before me who were fairly rebellious. They were sort of like teddy boys, you know. So my dad, by the time it came to me, he felt he was getting a bit too old for it and he'd given up and let me do what I want.
Mm.
Glad he did.
Glad he did. We all benefited from your father's decision. Do you remember your first, the music in the Stewart home?
We're always, I can remember my childhood, we were always having parties every weekend, and especially at Christmas, we used to have huge parties and birthday parties for everybody. And there used to be, you know, like 60 or 70 people gathered around the house. And my first recollection of really falling in love with any sort of music would have been Al Jolson. So
wow.
I'm still an Al Jolson fan to this day.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we even now when we get family get-togethers, we all stand around and sing Al Jolson songs. My eldest brother still reckons that he is the singer in the family, and he has got a better voice than me. I mean, it's in tune more than my voice.
Really?
He thinks he should have been the singer in the family.
But you always had the hair.
Yeah, I had the hair. Yes, he has lost the hair.
Wanted me, but remember one thing, don't lose your head. keep a young man alive. My body's stunk, but I kept my funk. Woo! At a time when I was wild out of love, getting desperate, indeed I was. Yeah, you're looking like a tourist attraction. Sincerely thought I was so complete. Look how wrong it can be. The women I've known, I wouldn't let tie my shoe. They wouldn't give you the time of day. But the slit-eyed lady knocked me off my feet. God, I was glad I found her. And if they Shelly O'Keefe's, 'cause it's all been said before. Make the best out of the bad, just laugh it off. Ha! You didn't have to come here anyway. So remember, every picture tells a story, don't it? Every picture tells a story, don't it? Every picture tells a story.
With Every Picture Tells a Story, I remember that one because Woody was terribly drunk that night. He kept falling off his stool. In fact, if you listen to the CD, you can hear Woody coughing and spluttering all the way through that track.
No.
Yeah. But I remember singing along to it. Once again, Every Picture Tells a Story. The only bit I had was Every Picture Tells a Story.
The chorus.
You know, yeah. The chorus bit, which the chorus, it comes right at the end.
From Al Jolson family sing-alongs, Rod Stewart moved on to other kinds of music, including rock and roll.
I remember the first ever rock and roll record I heard was Little Richard, The Girl Can't Help It. And my brother, not my eldest brother, the one in between, bought that home. And I remember playing it until it just fell apart. And then my eldest brother, shortly after that, took me to see Bill Haley and the Comets, a live show in London.
Mm.
But even at that point, the seed wasn't actually sown, because when I was at school, I fell in love with American folk music first. The likes of Woody Guthrie and Daryl Adams and Ramblin' Jack Elliott. So I really fell in love with American folk music before I fell in love with rock and roll. I'm an old folkie, you see. That's why I earned my living when I left school. Well, I was played football for a little while, professional soccer, and I was a grave digger, everybody knows that. And then I sort of went on the road, as it were, and busked my way through Spain and France, just playing outside cafes and busking.
Now tell us what busking is.
Busking is, what do you call it in this country?
Panhandling, street corner singing.
Yeah, just street corner singing, yeah. That's what I did outside of cafes in Paris, in Saint-Germain, all along the left bank there. Very good period of my life, that. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I recommend it to anybody.
Clearly, there's a touch of autobiography in the lyrics of the title song, Every Picture Tells a Story. So I asked Rod Stewart if his father really said, son, you better see the world.
He didn't encourage me to get out on the road. I asked his permission. He said, yeah, go ahead and do it. Do whatever you want to do. He'd given up with me by then. You know, he even gave me some money. He gave me a few pounds to be on my way. Remembering, in fact, that he bought me my first guitar for no apparent reason.
Really?
Yeah. He just, to this day, I still don't understand why he bought it. Just went out and bought me a guitar. Very, very strange.
You remember that first guitar?
Yes, it was a £7 Zenith guitar.
Zenith guitar.
And I've still got it.
No, you still have it?
Still got it, yeah. It's at my parents' house in London. It's up in the attic there. Yeah, always when I go back, always get it out and give it a good old strumming. Still got a lot of the sand off of Brighton Beach in the inside of it as well. It has.
No.
Because we used to, Brighton Beach was a place we used to all gather when I was a beatnik. You know, we used to be beatniks, you heard of beatniks.
Sure.
Well, I used to be the guitar player there singing songs on the beach. And I looked, last time I looked at it, I opened it up, there was tons of sand inside the guitar. I got busted for being a vagrant in the end. That's how I got sent back.
From?
From, I think it was either Barcelona or Madrid. We were sleeping inside a football stadium, believe it or not. In the stands, about 10 of us, you know, and we got caught there, and we got sent back to London.
No kidding.
Got our passports taken away, back to London. So that was the end of that era. At the time, I was a beatnik. I had hair right down my back. I mean, you're talking about mid-60s, you know, when it was absolutely unheard of to walk around with hair down your back. So when I got sent back from Spain, I decided to cut it all off, and I became a mod. I cut it real short, and that's how the Rod the Mod thing came about.
Really?
So I started listening to James Brown and Otis Redding and Sam Cooke. And to this day, I still listen to those guys. They've stayed with me. So totally, within the space of, you know, 2 days, I totally changed my image completely. And suddenly everything was different. And that, shortly after that, was when I got into music. You know, I was asked by Long John Baldry on a railway station in London to join his band. You've heard of Long John Baldry,
sure.
Yeah. Asked to join his band.
In a railway station?
Yeah, I'd just been over to see the Rolling Stones play over at Twickenham. There was only about 30 people in the audience. Must have been, I was about this close to the stage. There were 30 people around there.
For
all
the Stones.
Playing. Brian Jones was on guitar. Ian Stewart was playing piano. And they all sat on stools. They all used to sit down and play on stools. And yeah, Mick used to play the harmonica on a stool. It was funny. And so I was on my way back to London. And John had been to see them as well, and I was drunk and on the railway station playing harmonica and singing. He said, young man, why don't you join my band?
Did you know who
he was? He needed a backup
singer.
Oh, I knew who he was. He was real big time around London at that time, you know. It was a marvellous scene around then, because it was a time when the Yardbirds were just busting and the Stones were just getting going and the Animals were coming down and playing in London. It was a tremendous time.
Rod Stewart sang with Long John Baldry's bands for the next few years, but in 1966, Rod got his biggest break when he was hired by a guitarist who'd recently left the Yardbirds. Rod Stewart got his first taste of the big time as the lead singer in the Jeff Beck Group.
That was the breakthrough. If it wasn't for Jeff, I may never have come to America. I mean, that was some band to be in. You know, we did our first concert at the Fillmore East in New York, and I hid behind the amplifiers and sung because I was so scared. Major curse of stage fright I had that night.
Have you ever had that before or since?
Oh, yeah, I get it every now and then. But that was a tremendous, tremendous period. A great band to be in. Ronnie Wood was playing bass and Jeff on guitar, Mickey Waller on drums and me singing and Nicky Hopkins on piano. It's a real good band. We were all in New York, yeah, the day before the concert. We were all there to do Woodstock. And he had some trouble with his home life, and he said, that's it, I'm going home. Well, he was always doing that on tour. He was always just getting on a plane and going home, leaving us there. But he did it the day before Woodstock. So that was more or less when the band folded up.
The recording sessions for the album Every Picture Tells a Story began at Morgan Studios in London in November 1970.
The first track I did was the Dylan song, because I always like to go in the studio and do a track that we know, we got the chords of, so that, you know, one leaves the studio in a good mood for the following night. But I just wanted the guys to feel good about, you know, get the feel of the studio and accomplish something. Then the next day we start on the original stuff.
That's a brilliant idea. Did you pick that up from some of the old pros, or is that something you came up with yourself?
No, I just came up with myself, and I still do that nowadays.
Today was not an endless highway, if tonight was not a crooked trail, if tomorrow wasn't such a long time, then lonesome would mean nothing to you at all. Ah, but only if my own true love is waiting. Yes, and if I could hear a heart softly pounding, only if she were lying by me, would I rest in my bed once again. I can't see my reflection in the mirror. I can't speak the sound that show no pain. I can hear the echoes of my footsteps and can't remember the sound of my own name. Ah, but only if my own true love is waiting. Yes, and if I could hear a heart as softly pounding, only if she were lying by me, would I rest in my bed once again. There's beauty in the silver singing river. There's beauty in the sunlight in the sky. But none of these and nothing else can steal the beauty that I remember in my true love's eyes. Ah, but only if my own true love is waiting. Yes, and if I could hear a heart softly pounding, only if she were lying by me, would I rest in my bed once again. Ah, but only if my own true love is waiting. Yes, and if I could hear a heart as softly pounding, only if she were lying by me, would I rest in my bed once again.
Tomorrow's Such a Long Time, written by Bob Dylan and interpreted by Rod Stewart on Every Picture Tells a Story. When we come back, we'll hear how a song that almost didn't make the album became Rod Stewart's biggest hit ever. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with the 45th anniversary of Every Picture Tells a Story.
This is Rod Stewart, and Every Picture Tells a Story when you're in the studio.
And I'm Redbeard. Welcome back. Rolling Stone magazine ranks the album Every Picture Tells a Story at a lofty 171 all time. Part of what made Every Picture Tells a Story so appealing was its lack of pretension. The atmosphere during the recording sessions was, to say the least, relaxed.
Oh, I tell you another story about the making of Every Picture Tells a Story. Mickey Waller, the drummer, when he turned up to do Maggie May, turned up with half a kit because he was the laziest guy in the world. He never to this day has had a full drum kit. I remember he turned up, he was either without cymbals or without hi-hat, and if you listen to Maggie May, there's one of the two missing. He turned up and all he had was just a hi-hat and a bass drum, and maybe the bass drum was missing, but half the kit was missing when we did Maggie May.
Thank you.
Maggie May was the song that changed Rod Stewart's life forever. Within weeks of its release, the song was number one in both Great Britain and the United States. And the whole album, Every Picture Tells a Story, soon topped both charts as well.
It's a true story, give or take a lie or two. It's a very true story. I had no idea it was going to be that big. I mean, no idea whatsoever. If you'd have told me in 1970 that you're going to have a number one single in America and all around the world, really, I would say, forget it. Especially as Maggie May nearly didn't make the album, because no one really liked it at the time, because it didn't have a hook line or something you could sing along to, you know. And I was thinking about taking it off. And even when it came out, Reason to Believe was the A side, and I think Maggie was the B side, first of all, and it got swapped over.
And do you know how that happened? I mean, because record companies...
Some disc jockey in Cleveland, I think, swapped it over.
No kidding.
I think it was Cleveland, yeah.
So Maggie May almost didn't make...
Almost didn't make the album.
Tells the story. Yeah.
Simple twist of fate. It was all made on Matus Rosé and Martini Rossi. I remember that was used to be the prerequisite from the band. Mm. We used to have a bottle of rosé and a bottle of Martini Rossi, and it would be gone by the end of the evening, but by God, we got some tracks. I can't remember much about it because it was done a long time ago under a big cloud of alcohol. But I don't remember us doing more than four or five takes of any of the tracks. I think the one that took the longest was probably with the Faces, because I couldn't get them out of the pub. So it's the trouble with the Faces, we could never get us out of the pub.
I'm losing you.
I Know I'm Losing You was originally a hit for The Temptations, covered by Rod Stewart with help from his Faces mates on Every Picture Tells a Story. When we come back, you'll learn how Rod Stewart found some of the unconventional musicians on this album. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Rod Stewart for the 45th anniversary of Every Picture Tells a Story.
This is Rod Stewart, and Every Picture Tells a Story when you're in the studio.
And I'm Redbeard. Rod Stewart's unexpected solo success put a great strain on his relationship with the other members of The Faces. The new Faces record, Long Player, had been out for 3 months and had barely cracked the top 40 when Rod's Every Picture Tells a Story solo was released, and it zoomed straight to number one. Suddenly, all the attention changed from The Faces as a group to Rod Stewart as a solo artist.
Promoters used to put out Rod Stewart and The Faces, and in the contract, unbeknownst to the boys and myself, when the band arrived in town, the Rod Stewart had to come down so none of the rest of The Faces didn't see it.
I remember
one night,
the
promoter didn't bother to take down my name. You know, well, they you can't blame the promoters.
All they want to do
is sell tickets, you know,
right.
And I just had a big hit album, so obviously they want to put my name up there. But
that's right.
It did cause a hell of a lot of embarrassment. It really did. A lot of heartache. And as I said, that was, you know, why Ronnie Lane left. It started as a bunch of guys who were basically all out of work, like we were, and they were becoming a backup band, you know. I don't think it ever really bothered Woody. You know, Woody's a happy-go-lucky guy, but it bothered the others. I think that was probably the start of the bust-up of The Faces, really. Ronnie Lane didn't like it at all, you know. It embarrassed me, because I only signed a solo deal to do things that I thought The Faces wouldn't do, because I intended to stay with The Faces until the end.
You did.
Well, I did, yeah. Well, us British are very loyal, you know, very, very loyal. Especially in the music business, we tend to be very loyal. I have to be pushed into situations. I had to be pushed to leave The Faces and go in a solo career. And they were good mates, you know. They weren't like... I can never understand bands that go on the road and they dislike each other and they hate touring. And, I mean, why do it? I mean, we were mates. We were like blood brothers, The Faces. Once Ronnie Lane had left, I'd lost a lot of interest in it. And once Mick had approached Woody to join the Stones, even though Mick had sworn on his mother's life that he would never do that... once Woody had gone, obviously, there was no point in carrying on.
If I listen long enough to you, I'd find a way to believe that it's all true. Knowing that you lied straight-faced while I cried, still I look to find a reason to believe someone like you makes it hard to live without somebody else. Someone like you makes it easy to give. Never think about myself. If I gave you time to change my mind, we'll be right back.
like you makes it hard to live without somebody else. Someone like you makes it easy to give. Never think about myself. Someone like you makes it hard to live without somebody else. Someone like you makes it easy to give. Never think about myself.
It's not what you sing in tune, because by God, Jagger's never sang in tune in his life, and neither has Dylan, but the emotion is there, and the style, and you just know it's them singing. I think that's the most important thing.
Sure.
And I get asked this question so many times, you know, what makes a great singer? And I wouldn't say it's a great voice always. It's a style, having your own style of singing. Whether you hit the note on, you know, in pitch, or whether you sing particularly in tune, it's just having a great style.
Rod Stewart brought together a variety of musicians for this album. Ron Wood and Ian McLagan from The Faces, drummer Mick Waller from the old Jeff Beck group, guitarist Martin Quittenden, with whom Rod Stewart co-wrote Maggie May, and there were some others from unlikely places as well.
It was done all live, apart from a few mandolin overdubs, but nearly everything was played live. And I wouldn't say we spent more than one day doing any track. It's not like we'd do one track and then come back and do it again the next day. Because I was on a budget. I had, I think, $50,000 to make the album.
Period.
And if I get for $30,000, I've got a little change left over of spending money, beer money, through the rest of the year.
Which is very important.
Very, 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 very handy. So that's how it was done. It really was down one track a day. And sometimes I had no idea what the vocals were going to be over the top of it. As long as it felt right, I'd be humming along and then just go home and write the lyrics. Frightens me nowadays, the idea of producing. I mean, it's like...
Why?
It just does. Those days, I had nothing to lose, you know. There was no worries about having one, two, or even three hit singles on an album. You know, I never used to worry about singles. It was all about making a nice album. It was like writing a book. You know, one track went into the other. You didn't have to worry about singles. But nowadays, you've got to worry about three singles to be able to compete. Hopefully those days will come back, you know, and hopefully those days of acoustic instruments, I forecast there will be a return to that use of acoustic mandolins, violins and pianos, you know, and there's nothing more charming in rock and roll than if you get it right with a nice acoustic guitar and a big drum sound. It works perfectly. It's amazing how I come across some of these musicians, because I remember Dick Powell, the marvelous violin player that played on two or three of the albums in that period. I found him in a restaurant, in a Russian restaurant called the Borscht and Tears, which is in Beecham Place in Knightsbridge in London. I found him playing in a restaurant, and he couldn't believe it. I said, I want you to come down and play on a record. The guy had never played on a record in his life, let alone a rock and roll record, and let alone for a lot of drunkards like ourselves. So that was very interesting.
And he played violin on...
Well, everything, all the violin, all the... there's only one violin player, that's all we could afford. he played violin on everything. Could I ever get away with this? It's an insult to the guy. The mandolin player was played by the mandolin player in Lindisfarne.
And I can't recall his name at the time.
To this day, I still don't remember his name. And he played that lovely lick on Maggie May, you know.
And his name's not even on the record.
I still don't know his name.
Well, at least you're an honest man.
I used to get more of fun in those days out of doing the liner notes than I did making the albums. I used to have great fun doing those. Used to take 2 months doing the liner notes and a week doing the album.
knew how much you loved the sun. But you chose to stay and keep me warm through the darkest nights I've ever known. If the mandolin wind couldn't change a thing, then I know I love you. Oh, the snow fell without a break. Buffalo died in the frozen field, you know, through the coldest winter in almost 14 years. I couldn't believe you kept a smile. Now I can rest assured, knowing that we've seen the worst, and I know I love. Romantic words, so the next few lines come really hard. Don't have much, but what I've got is yours. Except, of course, my steel guitar. 'Cause I know you don't play, but I'll teach you one day, because I love.
Rod Stewart's Mandolin Wind with Ray Jackson on mandolin. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. In the Studio is a Bullet production, produced by yours truly, Redbeard, and Joe Rhodes at Omega Audio in Dallas. Written by Joe Rhodes. Engineer, Doug Hall. Assisted by Philip Barrett. Executive producer for In the Studio is Steve Smith. Thanks for joining us, and please be with us next week for the making of another of rock's greatest albums, In the Studio.